NYPD Detective Vic Ferrari, and welcome to NYPD Through the Looking Glass podcast, where you'll get unique insight into the New York City Police Department. Before we get started, I encourage you to check out my Amazon author page, where you'll find my series of behind-the-scenes NYPD books for $10 paperback and $2.99 ebook download. And that includes Grand Theft Auto, the NYPD's auto crime division. It's a book that's got everything you wanted to know about the stolen car industry. Who steals your car? A car thief's mindset. What happens to your car after it goes into a chop shop? And again, that's on Amazon, $10 paperback. On today's episode, we're going to discuss what it was like to be a New York City police officer in the early 90s. I'd like to welcome an old friend and my former NYPD co-worker, Marty. Marty, welcome to the show, and thank you for coming on.
Vic, it's my pleasure.
My pleasure.
What's it been, like 33 years since we met?
Well, I left the job in 1994 to go up to a suburban department. So,
Well, Marty and I, getting on 30 years. Yeah, we met in the 50th precinct, and I think it was 1990. I had done a couple of years in the South Bronx. I wanted a change of pace, which we'll get to on another podcast. And Marty was a rookie cop, and Marty got assigned to the 50th precinct because Marty's dad was actually a detective that worked upstairs in our precinct detective unit. Marty, what was that like for you to be a young patrolman? You know, your first command out of the police academy, and now you're working in the same building as your dad.
Well, I started out in the field training unit, which turned out of the 4A precinct and covered the 4-0, 4-2, 4-4, and the 4-A. As we were approaching the end of our training, and we're about to be sent out to commands, my father asks me, a couple of my friends are Bronx delegates. They're asking where you might want to work. So I said, I love the guys in the 4-4. I love the 4-0. I said, either one of those commands, that or the 4-6.
So you wanted to go to a very busy precinct. You wanted action, because that's the precinct that you named at that in that time period was some of the busiest, roughest precincts in the Bronx.
Right. So the time comes where the lieutenant of our training unit is reading out the list of commands everyone's going to. He gets down the list. He says, flatly, 5-0. And, of course, I raised my hand and I said, lieutenant, there seems to be a clerical mistake. And he says, there's no mistake, you're 5-0. So I was furious. You know the heavy houses and you know the quiet houses. So as soon as I could, I got to a payphone because there was no cell phones, and I called my father. And I said, Dad, what happened? And he says, I don't know. He goes, I told the guys where you wanted to go. And to this day, he's 84 years old. He will not admit to me that he brought me to the 5-0. And it was probably because he wanted to shelter me in some way. It worked out. He wanted to keep an eye on me. It was tough, though, because, you know, daddy's upstairs. And, you know, cops will bust each other's chops.
I did.
Yes. But it was, people liked my father, fortunately, so they took me in rather quickly and made it easy for me.
Well, your dad, so just to paint a picture for people that are listening that don't know how the NYPD works, the detective squad is up on usually on the second floor of every NYPD precinct. And in that time period, the early 90s, it was like stepping into an episode of Barney Miller. Because for the most part, everybody that worked upstairs, there were exceptions, but everybody that worked in a PDU was north of 40, right? So you had a great divide. You know, here you are, a 23, 24-year-old kid with an arrest. You bring it up to the squad, and it's, what do you got, kid? It's these salty guys in polyester suits. Back then, I mean, times have changed, but back then, the PDU, or Precinct Detective Unit, that was one of the most coveted places to work in the department. Nobody really knew their hours. They basically came and went as they pleased. If you had a good squad commander, which was usually a lieutenant, you made your own tours. It was probably the greatest gig in the department before comp. And up in the PDU, Marty, you probably remember this, on the walls, on the border of the walls, they had phone numbers written in Sharpie on Oak Tag of every federal agency, NYPD agency imaginable. Like, you would just walk up there and look, and it would say DEA, ATF, FBI. I remember they had a phone number up there for a psychic. You know, it was crazy. You would go in there, and it was like, you really felt like you were in an NYPD precinct.
And every squad looked the same. You could go to any precinct, and pretty much they were identical.
And you had those old heavy-duty IBM typewriters with the steel ball going, and you had tit-tit-tit-tit. And they had typists sometimes in some precincts. I know we did. And you'd hear the detectives banging on those typewriters. I mean, it was that sound of that ball striking paper is, like, ingrained in my brain, like, 40 years later.
The thing that gets you, and there are memory joggers, sound is one of them, and also smell, like, if you go into a precinct now, whether it's the cleaning chemicals or whatever it is, the building and the stairwell down to the locker room smells exactly the same. And it brings it all back.
Yeah, I haven't stepped in. The last precinct I stepped inside of was the 5-0 after my parents had left me. I had to go up to New York and sell their house and everything and take care of everything. And I said, let me just go by the precinct. And you're 100% right. I mean, this is 10 years ago. I stepped in, and it was like stepping back in time. And you're right. The smells of the cleaning products and the sounds, the radio. I mean, as soon as you start hearing that radio, your ear comes back, where you can hear the different sectors going to different places, whereas most people wouldn't know what they're listening to. Immediately, like, your mind takes you there.
But you said Barney Miller as a visual, and I think was one of the more accurate police shows of all time. It very well portrayed the Detective Bureau. Hill Street Blues and NYPD Blue were the patrol side, but Barney Miller was the Detective Bureau.
You're right, because Hill Street Blues showed what it was like downstairs with the desk officer, and he's basically like the captain of the Titanic, and the sea of humanity just keeps coming up to the desk. Arrests are coming in. People are bringing in lost wallets. My child is missing. I mean, it never stops. It just keeps going and going, and Hill Street Blues was a busy precinct.
Yes.
They showed on television.
Yeah. An A-house.
It was not.
An A-house.
Yeah, the 5-0, they used to call it Riverdale Police or Hawaii 5-0, because at the time, really, what they have, maybe 6-7 homicides a year, where different NYPD precincts, you had well over 100 coming in. And what was unique about our precinct is there was a great divide between the young pups like us, and you had a lot of old men. Well, you know, my age now, but we perceive them as old men, guys in their late 50s, even into their early 60s, like getting close to that man we forced you off the job at 62 years old. And what was wild about that precinct is the department, when you screw up in the NYPD, they dump you. It's called highway therapy. So if you live in the Bronx and you screw up, they're going to send you to Brooklyn. If you live in Brooklyn, they're going to send you out to Queens. They just move you around the chessboard. And usually they'll send you to an A house or a shitty precinct. The 5-0 was unique in that it would send people there that they couldn't quite put their finger on. Like, they couldn't quite prove they did something wrong, but they wanted to keep an eye on them. So they shipped them off to a place where they figured nothing's going to happen here.
Right. Oh, you like to make collars and you're going to kill us in overtime, so we'll send you to the 5-0. And you'll cool your jets there, and you'll cool your jets. But the problem was, when you sent a number of guys who really liked to work and they were used to finding things, and you put them with the young guys, like you said, they start to import that knowledge, and then it's the hunter mentality is starts to grow. And they all, like, especially the Fort Itself tour, they all go out there and start looking, and now. Their tutors are guys that worked in those busy houses.
Right, and like you said, it starts planting seeds, and the young guys start learning things. What was unique, too, about the 5-0 as a slow precinct, I don't know if you were there. Yeah, you had to have been there because we got there about the same time. We lost three guys in less than a year to drugs. It seemed like every 4 months – someone was getting dole tested, which is the NYPD random drug test, and would test positive for drugs. And the next thing you know, they were gone. There was an empty locker, and everybody around the station, I was like, can you believe what happened to this guy? Can you believe what happened to that guy? There was a guy that had the he was nursing an injury, and he had the Steady TS, which is the telephone switchboard, and he always was smiling. But looking back, he was always high. He had a heroin problem. And what he would do is, when the desk officer would go to use the bathroom or take a break, he would go behind the desk, and in every NYPD precinct, you have what's called a property locker. So arrest evidence, found property, it gets vouchered, it gets cataloged, it gets placed in these property lockers behind the desk, they're locked, and then a property clerk inventories it and then takes it downtown. So it's like a weighing station for property in an NYPD precinct. And a property locker can contain guns, cash, drugs. Well, what this cop would do is he would wait till the desk officer left the desk area for a couple of minutes, go behind the desk, take a key, open up the locker, and was using drugs, and then he was stealing money. So he was tearing open security envelopes with cash, and then he would take the envelopes and stuff them behind the locker. And his drug habit was so bad that your old partner, who ran the precinct club one day, comes up to me and he goes, you know, you're an asshole. And I started laughing. I go, what are you talking about? Because I was known as a practical joker. He goes, Ferrari, do me a favor. Stop taking dollar bills and stamping it with the red evidence stamp and putting it in the vending machines. He goes, because when I'm making deposits at the bank, there's $5 or $6 that's marked stamped with the red evidence seal. He goes, and they're looking at me funny at the bank. And I go, that's pretty funny. And had I thought of it, I would have done it. But it's not me. And what it was is this cop was so out of it, he was stealing so much money, he was, and that high, he was using the cash that he was stealing that was stamped with red evidence and using it to buy a Snickers bar and a Coke. And the way they caught him was he bounced a check at Jesse James, the bar that was two doors down, and we'll get to that later, and he refused to pay them. So they called Internal Affairs, they started following this cop around, and they saw him trying to sell a couple of guns up in Washington Heights that he had stolen from the property locker, so they arrested him immediately, and then eventually he was fired for drugs. Do you remember that?
Yes. He was using the money to get drugs. He was using the drugs and then putting guns up back on the street in his late-stage desperation.
Yeah, and that precinct, we had so many characters that worked there. It happened just before we got there, but there was a cop from our precinct that was tasked with doing the borough mail run. So for you listening out there, NYPD is run like the McDonald's Corporation. So think of One Police Plaza as Hamburger U or McDonald's corporate headquarters, right? Every borough, Bronx, Brooklyn, there's an office called the borough. That's like the district office. And everything runs through the borough, and then from the borough it goes to Police Plaza. And then think of the NYPD precincts as franchises. That's the McDonald's franchise. So a couple of times a week they have what's called a mail run. And a cop from a precinct is assigned to go to the borough. He picks up the mail, and then he's assigned to going across the entire borough and delivering mail to the various units. So we had a cop in the 5-0. He was a nice guy. He goes down to the Harbor Unit in the South Bronx, and they had a dog. And the Harbor Dog didn't know the guy, and the Harbor Dog starts barking at this cop doing the mail run, and he shoots the dog. So that was a big incident, and he was forbid forever going to the Harbor Unit. You just can't make this stuff up. And we were talking off air the other day when we were getting ready for this interview. We had an administrative lieutenant who was a Vietnam veteran who was a colorful character. You want to talk about him?
Without naming names.
Of course not.
Back then we had revolvers, so we had speed loaders, which were
six bullets on a circle that you could shove into.
Yeah, circle, and you drop it into the cylinder and turn the screw, reload your gun. Most guys had two. A couple of guys had three. I used to carry three. This particular boss had at least six, three on each side, and I seem to remember it could have even been four on each side of his belt. So I asked him, I said, what's with all of the speed loaders? And he says, Sonny, I was a Vietnam veteran and in a firefight, I ran out of ammunition one night. And he said, I vowed that would never happen to me again. And he gives me a wink and he walks away.
He was a nice guy, but like he worked in the basement. His office was in the basement and he always wore his bulletproof vest. Probably 10% of NYPD cops or bosses when they're working just inside the station house are going to wear their vest. You're supposed to wear it at all times, but a lot of times guys don't. He always, and he wore the heavy duty vest. So he looked like he was wearing a fat suit, and he wasn't a fat guy, but you would always see him walking around, and he was another one of those guys that refused to buy short sleeve shirts. It could be August, 100 degree weather, and he'd be walking around in a long sleeve shirt rolled up.
Like Inspector Gadget.
Yeah, he was Inspector Gadget. He had knives, he had all sorts of crap. Now, let's not forget, there was an infamous sergeant in the 5-0 who hated everybody, except you and I, and in my book, I refer to him as Roast Beef Ray, because the only thing I ever saw him eat was a roast beef sandwich. He would order 5 days a week, roast beef sandwiches and a coffee. And he hated the young guys, but again, he liked us. And it was a flip of the coin at roll call. He would come in, and he would either point to you or I, and he would make this motion with his hands, like his hands on a steering wheel. And just to paint a picture of what this guy looked like, there was a cartoon in the 60s, 70s called The Wacky Racers. And there was this creepy-looking guy named Snidely Whiplash. And that's exactly who he looked like. Do you remember driving him, Marty?
A more modern-day comparison would be in the movie Casino, the James Woods character. He was reminiscent of that. Slick back hair and the greasy skin and smoking, the dandruff, the whole, you can imagine you could paint that picture in your mind. But yes, he liked me because he liked my dad who worked upstairs. And but that was the dreaded, like you said, at roll call, he'd be like flatly, and he'd do the driving symbol with the hand. And you knew you were going to have an awful night.
And there was no way getting out of it because he was the type of guy that would hold a grudge. He would actually nurse a grudge and raise it. And if you pissed him off, there was no going back. And he had – and I hate to say this about a human being, especially one of our own. He had no redeeming qualities. I remember driving him once, and a man died in his apartment, a middle-aged guy. He died on the toilet, and there was a Playboy magazine next to him. So it was fairly obvious how he died and what he was doing when he died. And the guy's sister was a little older than him. She was probably in her 60s. She found him. So she calls 911. The sector car shows up. They call for the boss. We show up. And, you know, what's going on? And she's in a bedroom crying. And I go into the bathroom with Roast Beef Ray, and there's this guy dead on the toilet with a Playboy magazine, and he can't stop laughing. He's laughing so hard. I mean, like, he's on his side. Like, I thought he was going to be the next person to drop dead in that bathroom, and he's laughing. And he's like, can you believe this? And then he's calling out to the cops that are in the next room that are trying to console this woman. Can you believe this guy died beating his meat on the toilet? And, like, the woman is so out of it, thank God, that I don't think she was really paying attention to him. But it would be hard not to have heard him the way he was carrying on. And I'm like, hey, boss, I think we got to call at the other end of the sector. And he's like, no, look at this. And he's like showing me the magazine. I'm like, yeah, I get it. You know what I mean? But, boss, I you know, like I was trying to get him out of there. Like I was the parent in that situation.
I'd be surprised if he didn't take the magazine.
That's the kind of guy he was.
He loved to leer at girls when we drive up and down Broadway.
Oh, my God. He would sit next. See, now you're going into a dark place because I don't want to repeat what he said. I was working with him one time, and he saw this really attractive woman. And here I am, a 24, 25-year-old kid. And it's like, you know, I'm the smartest kid. I grew up in the Bronx. And he would talk about them. And, like, I was put off. You know what I mean? Like, here I was a guy and a cop, and everything's supposed to roll off my back. And, like, the way he would talk about women, I was just, like, creeped out by it. Like, it was just odd to me that a man of that age with like serial killer type shit. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh, like, I just looked at, I always knew he was a scumbag, but that really kind of moved my agenda where I just didn't want to look at him anymore.
That awful character.
He was an awful character. And then the 50th precinct had, it was like three different police departments. You had the day shift, which for the most part, a lot of those cops were useless. They'd come in late, they'd leave early, they were in the bar 5 minutes before their tour ended. Wanted nothing to do with police work. And I don't know if you remember, we had two very large, out-of-shape female cops. And unfortunately for me, my partner and I would get their car after the day shift, because we were doing 4 to 12. And their gross tonnage was so large that it would break the bench seats in the Chevy Caprices. So we would,
and you have to put the milk crate behind it.
Look at the milk crate behind it. That's, I had to go to the dairy in the 5-0 on Exterior Street and borrow a couple of milk crates, because their weight would break the seats. So if you stepped in the gas, you fell into the back seat. So my partner and I would stick milk crates in the back seat to prop us up. And if we had a collar, we would put the milk crates in the trunk and put the bad guys in the back seat. And I'd have to drive like 15 miles an hour to the precinct so I wouldn't wind up in the back with them. And we would get the car from them, and in the back seat, it was like where they were grazing for the day. There was McDonald's bags, coffee cups, wrappers from a deli. It's like, and they never put gas in the car. So it was like 20 minutes of me and my partner putting gas in the car and cleaning out the crap. You know, it was like cleaning out a cafeteria every day.
And you had to deal with the funk that was left behind.
Oh, they were not cool. I mean, it just, and you tried talking to them, and they just didn't get it. Moving on from them, do you remember there was a guy? He came to the precinct. He had a little bit more time on. He used to leave his partner in the radio car and go to a tanning salon. You remember that guy?
Yes. Very muscular, like a bodybuilder's physique.
He was a bodybuilder.
A big fan of himself.
Yes, he was. He did own and operate his own fan club. And then, unfortunately, he got, I think, locked up in upstate New York for a burglary.
I don't know if that's unfortunate, but...
There were so many characters there. I'm going to bring up another guy who I think you're going to remember. He was kind of odd and had more time than us, probably had about 7 or 8 years on. He comes up to me one day, and he's looking at my feet. And I'm just staring at him. I'm like, can I help you? He goes, Fry, what size shoe are you? And I said, I'm a 9.5, 10. He goes, that's great. He says, how about you and I chip in and buy a pair of patent leather shoes? I said, excuse me? He goes, it makes total sense. We work different shifts. If one of us gets sent down to a detail or a parade, we can split the shoe. This way you have a good pair of shoes, I have a good pair of shoes. And I'm like, no, that's weird. I'm not buying it. You know what I mean? Like, what was a pair of patent leather shoes circa 1992? Like $25 maybe? I was like, no, that's okay. But one day I was working with him, and he says to me, you know what I like to do on my day off? And I'm like, lay it on me, brother. He says, I like to go to City Island. So I said, all right, oh, you like to go fishing? He goes, well, I like to rent those outboard motor boats. And I said, oh, so you go fishing in the Long Island Sound? He goes, well, not really. He goes, I like to go over by Hart's Island. Now, Hart's Island is this island. It sits in the middle of the Long Island Sound between the Bronx and Long Island. And that's Potter's Field. Like, there's over 1 million Department of Corrections runs a ferry boat with trustees, inmates, guys that are doing less than a year in jail. And they bring out, you know, people that are unclaimed from the morgue. They go out there in this ferry in pine boxes, and I'm sure now they
mass grave.
Back in the day, it was shovels.
Mass grave.
Yeah, and they just get, right, 8 deep. I think they bury them 8 deep in a grave. So I go, what do you go out there for? He goes, well, I don't go to the island. He goes, when no one's out there, I buzz around, and I start feeding the seagulls. I said, okay. He goes, and then I use them for target practice. And I said, excuse me? He goes, I'm quite the crack shot. And I'm just getting, like, weirded out. He goes, yeah, he goes, I'm that good that I can shoot the leg off a seagull. He goes, and it just kind of jumps around on one leg. And I was like, holy shit. Like, A, I wish
he's got a pit in his basement.
Yes, I went into roll call. That was one of those times. There was a wonderful Irish woman that worked there, Barbara, and I went up to her and I said, "Barbara, can you please do me a favor and never put me with him again?" She goes, "You know, you're not the first person that's come to me with that request. I'll see what I can do."
I remember Barbara now. You've just jogged a memory there. Very nice lady.
She was a wonderful woman. She lived on Broadway. She actually lived in the precinct. She unfortunately died of cancer. She was a sweet woman. A lot of people in roll call, that's like our clerical that basically pairs you with your partner, gives you the radio call, sends you to court, notifications for training. Someplace.
Very powerful position.
If you piss off the people in roll call, you're screwed. You're going to be standing.
You're going to every parade. You're going to every protest downtown in Manhattan.
Tour changes where you come into a 4 to 12 and they tell you, oh, yeah, tomorrow you got to come in at 7 a.m.
And good luck getting a steady partner, or, you know.
Yeah, oh, they would just make your lives miserable. Then we had another cop. Do you remember this guy? He used to feed the geese at the reservoir for weeks. He'd fatten them up. Then he'd run them over. He would fatten up the geese. You're like, "What are you doing?" "Oh, I'm just feeding the geese." Then he'd drive by and run them over. Then he'd put them in the trunk of his radio car, bring them back to the precinct, put them on ice in the trunk of his car, bring them upstate, and then he would cook them.
Oh, my God. You're going to have to tell me offline.
Yeah, I'll tell you off air of this person. Do you remember the cat fight? Were you there when we had the cat fight in the female locker room over parking summonses?
Oh, yeah.
You want to tell that story without naming names?
Well, I don't know all the particulars, it wasn't just about parking tickets. It was also about, as I remember, the solo female. Getting a lot of the attention, and the other two girls were jealous of the attention she got from some of the male cops. And they cornered her, and they pepper sprayed her too, right?
Well,
or she did. They were beating her, and
Well, as I remember it, yes, it was getting catty. You had two female cops that worked together, and then you had another female cop that worked with a male cop, and. One day, the female cop that worked with the guy went into the two female cops sector and wrote a bunch of parking tickets. And that's done all the time. You know, in the 70s, it was very big on stay out of my sector, don't get involved in my sector. And that, the reason they was doing that was cops pre-NAP commission were taking money and bribes. So if you were writing tickets in front of someone's store, that guy was giving you a free lunch back then. But that, I mean, that was all gone by the time we came around. So these two female cops were looking to start some shit. And they pull up alongside the female cop and her male partner, and they say, "Don't you be writing summonses?" And you know, and they had words, and they said, "You know what? After work, we're going to kick your ass." And they leave. So the female cop, instead of just saying, "You know what? Maybe I shouldn't go up to the locker tonight and wait till things cool down," she goes upstairs, and supposedly, I don't know this to be true, but supposedly she has her mace up in her hand. She gets up into the locker room. She's confronted by the two female cops. A brawl ensues. Mace is sprayed all over the place. All hell breaks loose. And her partner finds out about it and supposedly tells the lieutenant who's going home what happened. And he basically says, "Well, I'll straighten this out in the morning." Well, everybody wanted to push the issue. The article wound up appearing in the news. And everybody got transferred. I mean, it was
just another.
I mean, everybody was coming
just
up.
Just another story, another episode in the soap opera of the 5-0.
Well, you had a lot of young cops, and the old time sergeants named the 4-12 squad the runaway train, because there was a lot of off duty. You know, I mean, we were young; we were in our 20s, and there was a bar. Right next to the precinct. I mean, the building right next to the precinct was a bar, and it was a gold mine. It was called Pauline's. And I mean, you know, you're in your 20s, probably 2-3 nights, some guys more a week. You do your 4-12. You don't have to be at work till 3 o'clock the next day. You're 25 years old. You got all this energy. Let's go to Pauline's and have a drink. You remember Pauline's, don't you?
Yeah. A lot of locals.
A lot of locals.
And the cops.
And the cops.
And a lot of fraternizing and
a lot of fraternizing and
well, yeah, there was a lot of fraternizing. But what was unique about Pauline's was this is pre-direct deposit and ATM cards. You would get your check every other Thursday, and every cop would run to a check cashing place to cash their check. Pauline's was great if you didn't get a chance to do that. After work, you'd go into Pauline's, you'd give Pauline, that was the owner, your check. You'd sign the back of it, and then what she would do is, as long as you bought a drink or got something to eat, she'd take that out of your check, and you got paid. So Pauline's probably, and you got to remember, the 50th precinct probably had about 200 cops. Upstairs, you had warrants and the narcotics division. So you, that building probably
and emergency service.
And emergency service. Probably between 300 and 400 people, NYPD members. So I'm going to guess she probably had close to $100,000 on any given Thursday. And cops would come in. They'd get a couple of drinks. So what were we getting paid back then? Like $800 every 2 weeks or something? And, you know, you'd go in there and spend $40 worth of food and booze, and she'd take it out of your check, and you'd get $760. It was like the greatest thing in the world. And you're right. It had a lot of colorful characters that would come in and out of that bar. Do you remember there was an old black guy by the name of Murph? And he would come into the precinct on weekends after midnight. And he would dress like an Irishman. It was the craziest thing. He would wear green pants, a white Irish, like those Irish sweaters, and he always had those blinking buttons on him that he would sell that said, "Kiss me, I'm
Irish." And he'd sing Irish songs.
The plastic shillelaghs. Yeah, or he'd have a bag full of green lit pre-glow sticks, these lit up shillelaghs in a bag, and the "Kiss me." I just remember like leaving the bar, and you'd see him. He'd do something wrong with his leg. And he would like shuffle down Broadway with all this stuff, and no one fucked with him because everybody, he was like, even like the neighborhood residents wouldn't mess with him because he was like an icon in the bar. You'd go in there and there'd be Murph. He'd have like two drinks. He'd sell his buttons and, "Hey, Murph, how's it going?" And then he would leave. He would go up and down Broadway.
A lot of good people in that neighborhood.
A lot of good people in that neighborhood.
It really was. Now what was unique about Pauline's is upstairs, you had like a catering hall or a room where they had bachelor parties. Do you remember those?
I do, and the statute of limitations has long since expired, so we can continue to talk.
Yeah, I'm not going to go into whose bachelor party or what, but there was some wild time, and I'm not a bachelor party guy, but I went to one bachelor party one time, and they had a stripper. She was famous around the Bronx. And for our female listeners, if I'm going to, you know, this is a PG-rated show, but I'm going to go into something that you might not want to listen to. So if you might want to dip off for 30 seconds and come back in, because it's a wild
Sexy Selena?
Sexy Selena.
Yep. And yep. I walk into the bar, and she's laying on a table, and she's shooting eggs. Hard-boiled eggs, or maybe they were soft-boiled, but I think they were hard-boiled. She's shooting hard-boiled eggs out of her vagina across the room, and she's yelling,
Vaseline-covered eggs.
What's that?
Vaseline-covered eggs.
Yes, and she's shooting them out of her vagina across the bar, across this room, and, like, members of the wedding party are stepping up to the plate with a wiffle ball bat, and they're hitting the eggs back. Then you brought up the other day there was a guy with a lacrosse stick catching the
like
eggs.
A baby lacrosse stick.
Yeah, it was like I had never seen anything like that before. It was friggin' crazy.
Sodom and Gomorrah.
Oh my God. And then downstairs in Pauline you had that little shitty bowling game with sawdust that would get all over the floor, and there was a couple of neighborhood hustlers that would like take your money. You know, if you went in the bar twice, you knew their act. But, like, the young cops would come in, "Hey, kid," they'd make, like, 10, 15 bucks off of somebody, you know, and that would pay for their booze.
And then the other bars in the precinct, further up Broadway at 242nd Street, were near Manhattan College. So the younger guys would venture up there and see if they could attract the attention of the college students.
Well, you had all the girls, right, that we would go up there and chase the girls at characters. the Pinewood,
Dorney Malone's,
Terminal Bar, Dorney Malone. And then
Terminal.
And you had Dorney Malone's, that used to call it Horny and Alone. That was like the last one you would go to. Like if all else fails, you would go
the
to Pinewood. Dorney Malone's.
The Pinewood.
And what's funny is two doors down from the 5-0 was Jesse James Bar. That was like a more older crowd. But sometimes we would go in there, and what was unique about that bar, and I had never seen this before or after. Anytime you went into the bathroom, I guess the urinals smelled so bad, they would dump ice in the urinals. So every time you took a piss, it was like a game, like you were melting the polar caps.
As if the ice was going to make anything better.
The ice was going to make anything better.
No, and it didn't. And they used to have piss flies the size of bats. That's like the narcotics division. Like you would flush the urinal and like these things would come out and fucking buzz.
Biting flies.
Biting flies.
Oh, my God. I remember one time there was a fight in Characters, and this guy, they were dragging him. You had these big bouncers in Characters. We used to call them Irish stink-offs. Like, these guys had mitts, you know? And they were dragging. This guy was knocking people out. And it took about four or five bouncers to really get their hands on this guy. And they're dragging him out of the bar. And as they're dragging him out of the bar, he's punching and kicking and pissing everybody off on his way out the bar. That the whole bar is like a vacuum. Everybody went out in the street to kick this guy's ass, and he was fighting like a dozen people. It got so bad that you had the bartenders came from behind the bar grabbing shillelaghs and Irish lacrosse sticks, those hurling sticks, to kind of quell the violence outside. The DJ abandoned his post, and he ran outside to get a couple of licks in. I went behind the bar and hit a tap, threw a couple of bucks on the bar, and I forget who was with me. And we just sat there and watched the fight from outside because, God forbid, you get involved in something. But what were you saying the other day? You were telling me the other day you had a couple for a slow precinct. You had a couple of close calls where you almost had to take someone's life. Tell that story you were telling me about the robbery at the golf course.
So Van Cortlandt Park had within it a golf course. So my partner and I get a call that there's a group of teenagers doing armed robberies on the golf course of the golfer, taking their money and their beer and such. So we respond to the clubhouse. We put one of the victims in the back seat. I'm driving, so I'm driving on the cart paths. Suddenly he sees the group. And he says, that's them. So I go flying across one of the fairways.
In the police car.
In the police car. Of course. I hit the brakes. I slide to a stop just in front of this 12-foot chain-link fence. So I'm going to say probably seven or eight kids. They all hit the fence, and like gazelles, all but one of them goes over the top and into the woods. The heavy-set kid hits the fence, gets about halfway up, and falls back down. So we pop out. I'm on the driver's side. My partner on the passenger side. And at gunpoint, we say, put your hands up. The kid turns around, pulls the gun out from his waistband, and points it at my partner. So both of us
start to pull the trigger.
My partner and I.
My partner and I.
And it's about halfway back.
It's about halfway back.
And the kid in the same motion as pointing at my partner, he throws the gun down. So we put the handcuffs on him, and the adrenaline dump is just ridiculous. And it turns out it was a starter's pistol. And he was 13 years old, although he looked to be 16 or 17. And it would have been a completely justified shooting because he's an armed suspect. He's pointing a gun at a
police officer.
But imagine the fallout and the emotional trauma that you'd have to deal with the rest of your life if that trigger had been another half an inch. Half a second.
That. Unfortunately, the media has painted cops a certain way, and cops are more afraid of getting in trouble than they are of losing their own lives. And I've almost had to pull the trigger several times, and I'll get into that on another podcast. But it's when you almost shoot somebody, it's almost like when you're almost in a car accident. and by accident you go to a stop sign or someone blows through a red light and they almost hit you, there's, like you just said, there's that adrenaline dump, like, oh my God, had I been an inch closer to this, my life would have either been over or completely different. It would have changed the course of my life. And you had it happen a second time.
We get a call that there's a car full of guys. I think it was 230th and Bailey.
230th and Bailey.
4-12 tour.
4-12 tour.
The driver of the car pointed a gun at a pedestrian who was walking across the street with a pit bull. Pit bull lunged at the car. He says, keep that dog away from me or I'll kill it. Person calls the police. It wasn't the pedestrian. It had to be somebody who saw it. We respond, pull up to the car. Another RMP pulls up shortly thereafter. So I get out with my partner. Guns drawn, pointed at the driver. He brings his gun up. I suppose in an act of putting his hands up, but he had the gun in his hand, and it is pointing right at me. Again, you're talking to milliseconds here, so I start to pull the trigger because there's a guy in a car pointed a gun at me. And from the corner of my eye, I see the second RMP team, and the female cop is screaming, "Don't shoot him, he's a cop." She either dated him or she knew him from somewhere. And of course, you let the trigger go, and I let the guy have it verbally. But if she hadn't known this guy and knew he was a cop, they turned out to be plainclothes or undercover narcotics cops. He would have been dead. I mean, he was 10 feet away, he was sitting in a car. He can't return fire because I'm in uniform. And he would have been killed. And again, it would have been justified, technically. But you would have taken a cop's life.
And there were other guys in the car with him, right?
Right. And what are they going to do?
A couple of people. I mean, the bullet could have, you might have let two shots go. One might have, you know what I mean? You might have missed him and hit somebody in the back seat. I mean, it happens. You know, it's all fun and games. You know, people want to screw around.
You're talking milliseconds.
Yeah, people want to screw around with the police and point guns at them or bait them that they got something in their waist when they really don't. And, you know, it's like, you know, it's unfortunate, but that's how people get hurt sometimes. And I mean, you know, he should have identified himself immediately, you know, or just let the gun go in his waist and put his hands up, you know, and say, you know, I'm on the job, I'm a cop, blah, 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 you know. And, you know, luckily for him, that female cop knew him, was able to give you the heads up before, you know, God forbid you had a tragedy.
That's the only reason that he's alive today.
Yeah. Yeah, listen, police work is a game of inches. Do you remember in the 50th precinct we had the Major Deegan Expressway that cut through the center of the precinct? Do you remember that mobile gas station up on 33rd Street?
On both sides.
On both sides. You had a gas station, right? It was just, you know, it's what it was is for us, especially on the 4-12, was a gold mine. Because you would get people from upstate New York, they would travel into the Bronx and Manhattan, they would buy drugs. And then what they would do is, on their way back up, that gas station was the last exit or filling station until Westchester County. And the gas station had a row of it looked like landing on an aircraft carrier as you were getting off the highway, because you had rows of parking spots and then you had the little gas station. And people would buy drugs, sometimes wait. You know, I'm not talking sometimes just a couple of vials of crack. I'm talking about half a key or a couple ounces of heroin.
And 50 they would decks of heroin.
Just to make sure they weren't. 50 decks of heroin. Yeah. They would park, A, to see if they got beat. Like, all right, let's see what I got. Or B, they were that much of a junkie, they couldn't wait to get home. They were going to take a taste. And what we would do on the 4-12s is we would go into that gas station and kill our lights. And you'd have cars just parked in this gas station. And we would just walk up to the cars. And you'd see a guy sitting there with, you know, a bag of white powder in his lap all over his nose and like, oh, shit. And like, yeah, do me a favor. Could you just step out of the car, please? We used to make, I mean, that was one of those. And if all else fails, you just went up to that gas station and just all you had to do was just walk up to the car because they never saw you coming. and it was well lit. So you had lights overhead, but they never saw us because we would just park and just slowly walk. Sometimes you didn't even have to shine your flashlight into the car. You could see what they were doing.
On the southbound side, they had a homicide. I think it was the attendant was killed. I think my father handled that one.
You know, that's funny you should bring... That's before we came on the job, right?
I thought I was in the precinct when I wasn't working, but I thought I was in the precinct when that happened.
There was another
I'd have to ask him.
The gas station, and I think it's the gas station, I might be wrong, on 252 and Broadway. You had an off-duty, I think he was a state trooper or something, and a guy went in to rob the place, and he had a 357 Magnum, the gas attendant. And he shot the guy, and the guy came stumbling out of the gas station and landed into the gas pumps. You remember that one?
No, I don't remember that.
One or two shots, and the guy, blew him, right? The guy came stumbling, like an old Western. Like, he hit him once or twice, and the guy just dropped his gun and went stumbling into the, he was like hanging off the gas pumps. I think I was driving Pete Marino. And the reason I wanted you on this show is because I had two former supervisors that worked in the 5-0, Pete Marino and Paul Fienza, and they gave their perspective as what it was like to be a supervisor. The reason I wanted to have you on is you were in that time period with us in the early 90s. You know, we were bouncing around, young guys, having a good time. And the other day, tell that story. The other day, I called you up, and we were going over what we were going to talk about, and how your wife was listening in the background and what she said.
Vic and I will, from time to time, just reach out and just catch up with what's going on. This time, like Vic said, you know, we were talking about, you know, funny stories from back when we were in the 5-0 working together. I'm in the family room. My wife is in the TV room. So we're talking for about an hour and a half, and I get off the phone, and she says, "Oh, I think that went really well." I said, "What are you talking about?" She goes, "You were doing the podcast, right?" I said, "No, I was just talking to Vic." She goes, "Oh, that was really interesting."
How long have you been married?
We're married. It'll be 26 years in September.
And she's hearing all these stories because, again, you left the NYPD after about 5 years, and then you went to work for a suburban police department. So she's hearing these stories, you know, and it's things that you wouldn't even think that she would think were interesting.
We only started dating in 93, a year before I left the city. And a side story here. Like you said, my father was a cop for 26 years in the city. And on the unfortunate occasions when a police officer was killed, I remember my dad calling home and speaking to my mother to let her know that you're going to see it on the news that a cop was killed in the city. I just want to let you know that it's not me. I'm fine. Just kind of as a courtesy so that she wouldn't worry. So when my wife and I started dating, police officer was killed in the Bronx, and I didn't want her to see, you know, officer killed in the Bronx, details at 11. So I called her, and I said the same thing. You're going to hear that a cop was killed in the Bronx. I just want you to let you know it's not me. And she immediately started crying, and she said, "I don't know if I can deal with this." Because think about it, you know, you're not in that life,
it just hit her like,
this is what he does for a living, this is who he is, and I either have to get used to that, or I have to just cut bait and move on. Unfortunately, she stayed.
Way to go, Deb!
Shout out to Deb.
What did you say? What was her comment about after you talked to one of your friends from the Bronx?
She said that whenever I speak to somebody from work, because I'm from a suburban county of New York City. So when I talk to somebody that I used to work with, she said for about a day or two, you have that Bronx accent that you used to have when we first met. Because you're immersed in it, and it just becomes part of your lexicon. And she just thinks it's funny that whenever you and I talk, that at least for a day, I kind of have that accent.
Well, I'm sorry for messing with your verbiage, but you know it is what it is. Is there anything you'd like to plug or promote on your end?
No. I'm not an accomplished author like yourself. I do enjoy reading your books, and I passed them on to my father and my father-in-law, and they both loved them.
Oh, thank you, Marty. I appreciate that. I didn't even think of that. And tell your dad, please, I said, he remembers me, right?
Of course, yeah. They make great stocking stuffers.
Great stocking stuffers. All right, Marty, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. And I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the content, I encourage you to check out my books on Amazon. Just type in my name, Vic, Ferrari Like the Car, and you can preview all my books for free, including NYPD Law and Disorder. Thank you again, and I'll have another episode out next week. God bless.